In the news.
Good morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for an introduction to American government.
Week number four.
That's right, week four. So
you thought there's nothing happening in the news. Well, you would be wrong.
Oh, it's constantly going on.
So four topics this week. We got four. You know, some people say three is the magic number. We like three, but we got four.
Four Beatles.
First thing we want to talk about today is actually a little bit of mop-up and clarification. We spoke about the illegal immigrants and their children at the border. I should be clear here. I don't mean disrespect when I say illegal immigrant. I'm referring to this in a very technical sense. I think the preferred term is undocumented workers, but in this case, we're using just the common vernacular, so I certainly don't mean any offense to anybody on that. We wanted to finish up with, when we left you last time, we described the crisis that was down there and the political backlash. President Trump did issue an executive order, I believe last Wednesday, and I wanted to go over that real briefly just to kind of give you a sense of what it was, because it's, you know, one of the most important news stories of the summer, and also to try to give it a little more context. So Professor McDaniel, I want to talk about it in the context of the court, of the course, and really talk about executive power versus legislative power versus court power. So what did the executive order actually say? What did President Trump do? Well, he ended this policy of separating children, minors, from their parents when they had been nabbed crossing the border. And he said his administration, these are some quotes, was put, quote, in the position of separating alien families to effectively enforce the law because of, quote, Congress's failure to act, unquote, and also court orders. All right, so in other words, Trump says he's blaming Congress and the courts. He said, that's why I had to issue an executive order ending or amending this policy. Now, it's briefly worth covering here. Now, what's he talking about with respect to court policies? Well, the administration has consistently maintained that it was forced to separate families. So migrants, potential immigrants crossing the border were caught by border authorities. And then children and parents were separated because the administration had concluded, and this isn't just the Trump administration, it was also the Obama administration, were interpreting what was called the Flores Settlement, which is from a case. The settlement, which was reached in 1997, I'm reading here because I want to make sure I get it right, required the government, that is the federal government, to limit the time that it keeps unaccompanied minors in detention and to keep them in the least restrictive setting possible. So that's the Flores Settlement that was reached in 1997, sort of a resolution of immigration, federal immigration policy. The settlement was later modified to say that children should not be held longer than 20 days. So that's the policy. It's talking about separating children. So, you know, their parents or whoever is bringing them across the border is accused of a crime. So they are treated in a criminal capacity. The children were then separated. This is part of this Flores Settlement. So what is it that Trump ordered? Trump directed Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen to maintain custody of the detained families during criminal proceedings and as their asylum claims are adjudicated. So what you're seeing, guys and girls, in a lot of these cases is that you have migrants crossing the border, they're caught by border security, and a lot of times they immediately claim asylum. They say they are fleeing from some sort of government oppression or political persecution in the host country. And therefore, they are entitled, they're not actually engaging in a criminal act, they're entitled to cross the border and achieve asylum in the United States. Right? So while these claims are adjudicated, keep these families together. Also, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis and heads of the other agencies are ordered to find or construct facilities to house the detained families. So that's another part of the executive order. Finally, the Attorney General Jeff Sessions was directed to prioritize the adjudication of cases involving detained families, right? So the executive order involves Homeland Security, Defense, and the Attorney General. All of this obviously within the rubric of the executive branch in the United States. So that's the change of policy. Now, what's interesting here is that this case actually, Trump can't do this unilaterally. He actually has to file a claim or a case with the relevant district court judge. In this case, the executive order directs the Attorney General to file a request with U.S. District Judge Dolly G, I hope I'm getting that right, G-E-E, in the Central District of California to modify the Flores settlement and to allow these detained migrant families to be held together. So prior to this point, President Trump had claimed, I can't do this because I'm bound by this court case, this decision, this Flores settlement. What changed with all these pictures of these families being separated and children in these facilities was the politics of it. So Trump initially, according to reports, said, I just want to do something. I am going to change the policy. And his attorney said, you can't. I mean, this is a matter of, you know, of court. You know, the courts ordered these things. You don't have the authority to do that. And you're not the Congress. You can't simply make up a law. So Trump said, all right, well, if I can't do that, I'm at least issuing this executive order. And, you know, I'm going to essentially notify the district court judge about this modification. The district court judge could say no, could say, in fact, that's not allowed. But we haven't had any ruling on them, probably won't for a little while. So the question now is whether the executive order is, in fact, legal. Meanwhile, Congress is doing what?
And so Congress, so while President Trump and the Trump administration has discussed this issue, one of the things, and really the way he's enforcing it, and again, the key thing about his decision was made more than 20 years ago, but this is the first time it's been enforced this in this manner, and Congress is trying to find a way to basically fix this loophole or this problem. So currently, you are having a number of meetings in the Senate to try to rectify the situation so that in the future, families will not be separated. Again, we had during the Obama administration, you had the issue of where you had a number of children coming to the border. And the issue was, what do we do with all of these children? And they're coming unaccompanied. Now you have the problem of children coming accompanied with their parents, and how do you process them? But another problem you're running into, and this is outside of the hands of Congress, is that because many of these children have been moved to different sites, how do you basically allow for the family reunification? So people have talked about that. Splitting up the families has been more expensive, but then also you run into the problem of reunification. And so this is something that's going to linger for a while. So it's not over yet. And there, as Professor Shaw pointed out, there's still some legal challenges that need to be dealt with. But then there are also a number of logistical issues regarding family reunification. But then also, how do we process these families in a way that is fair and just, but also in a swift manner?
Yeah, I think there's a nice quote, you know, from Reyna Torres Mendivil, Mexico's consul general in San Antonio. Told NPR's Audie Cornish that the process would be hampered by U.S. separation process, which keeps parents in federal custody while moving children into facilities controlled by DHS. The U.S., this is a quote, the U.S. authorities create different files for the children than for the parents, and it's very difficult to follow up on those cases. So, again, you know, this is obviously an interesting case for public policy and humanitarian reasons. It's something that, you know, we're really fascinated with as political scientists. But for purposes of the class, it's also just kind of, you know, an exemplar of the sort of triangulation between court and executive and Congress. And, you know, the president, as presidents often do, feels hemmed in. You know, the court says one thing, Congress is sort of at loggerheads and can't really act to produce immigration reform. So the president wants to act and doesn't like the pictures that are on television and thinks there's a humanitarian crisis, and, you know, basically did something he didn't think he could do a week and a half ago, which is to issue an executive order and then hope the court doesn't overturn it. So that's kind of where we are on that. All right. Let's see. A second topic we wanted to cover is are the upcoming 2018 elections, especially in the state of Texas. So the University of Texas, as you may or may not know, does its own poll along with the Texas Tribune, which is a terrific news organization, nonprofit news organization that was started up about 10 years ago. So it's the University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll, does a lot of survey work on attitudes and public opinion throughout the state of Texas. And they just came out with a poll early this week. And in the interest of full disclosure, I'm one of the co-directors of the poll. The poll had a lot of information on the upcoming election. And I wanted to go, if we could, to the tablet here. And in the tablet, we're going to show you some numbers from the poll. So hopefully you guys know this, but if you don't, in 2018, a midterm election, right, not a presidential in 2016 and 2018, 2018 is a midterm election. In the state of Texas, we have all of the statewide offices, as well as a Senate race this year. Ted Cruz's seat is up, and I know you see the numbers there, but let me go down. All right, so as you see on the tablet here, you've got a graphic that shows the current state of the race. So you've got Ted Cruz there marked by the red bar. Currently, Cruz is calling about 41% of the vote. Beto O'Rourke, the Democrat, the challenger here, 36. So right now, about a 5-point spread between Cruz and O'Rourke, which is a pretty close race in the state of Texas. The Democrats have not won a statewide race in Texas since 1994. Republicans have won every office in every year since then. You see the Libertarian there, Neil Diekman, at 2%, 3% say someone else, and then 17% say no opinion. So that's quite a sizable chunk of people who don't quite know who they're voting for yet. Now, by contrast, so that's the Senate race, right? If you move down to the governor's race, you see that Abbott, the Republican, the incumbent, is at 44, with Valdez at 32. So 6-point race in the Senate, but a 12-point race in the governor's. And then you see, again, a Libertarian is on the ballot, Mark Tippetts, drawing 4%, someone else 4%, and 16% no opinion. A lot of these races, you'll see high numbers of undecideds. Part of that is because it's early and people haven't really focused on the race. Part of it is because in the Texas Tribune, they don't ask what we call a push question. Most surveys, when they ask what they call the ballot question, will follow it up by saying, they'll ask people who say, I don't have an opinion yet. They'll say, well, if you had to choose, who would you vote for? That's called a push question. It's not a push poll. Don't be confused. It's a push question. And it's simply to get, we find, by the way, that people, when they say they lean a certain way, or if they had to vote, they'd vote that way, they actually end up doing that in the election. So push questions are okay. But that tends to produce, since they didn't have a push in the Trib poll, the UT Trib poll, you get a high number of undecideds, right? So you'll notice that, 16 and 17% undecided. And as you move to the down ballot races, you'll find even higher levels of undecideds. Okay, so by the way, I think the difference between the Beto O'Rourke Cruz matchup and the Valdez Abbott matchup kind of shows you the parameters of races in Texas right now. Abbott is a pretty strong incumbent. Valdez hasn't waged a very robust campaign, and so you see a 12-point spread. Cruz has some baggage from his presidential run and previous campaigns. Beto O'Rourke has run a very energetic campaign, and that's a 6-point race. So if you're interested kind of in, what are the magnitude of candidate effects or campaign effects in a statewide election, that's not a bad way to think of it, right? The difference between maybe O'Rourke being 6 points down and Valdez being 12 points down. Let's go back to the tablet here for just a sec. I just want to show you the lower races here. Here's the lieutenant governor's race. Dan Patrick, 37-31 over Mike Collier. Kerry McKinnon, the Libertarian, with 4. There you got 23% undecided. And if you cursor down the last ballot, we got here is the attorney general's race. And this is where Ken Paxton, who's had ethics problems and some questions involving campaign finance, is at 32%, and Justin Nelson, the Democrat, 31%. So that race is essentially a dead heat. And you see there, the Libertarian Michael Ray Harris is drawing 6%, so 2 or 3 points more than the Libertarian in the other races, and you got a full 26% undecided. So this is an indication of what happens when you have, it's a Republican incumbent, Paxton, with all sorts of allegations and issues, and that's the best the Democrats are doing is in that AG's race right now. So just wanted to give you guys a sense of where those races are. As we're moving forward, Democrats are hoping that O'Rourke at the top of the ticket can turn out Democrats. They're hoping that that Trump serves as the issue to mobilize Democrats and to get them fired up. And, the polls suggest that Trump's doing okay in Texas. I think he's 47% approved, 44% disapproved in the state of Texas. It's a pretty conservative state. He's only +3. But he doesn't seem to be a huge albatross in Texas, which is, I think, what Democrats are hoping for. Professor McDaniel, what do you think of these numbers? Any rays of light for the Democrats here?
I would say don't count your chickens before they hatch. I mean, the problem with the undecideds is in order for O'Rourke to be successful, he would have to capture 2/3 of those no opinion. I think the Paxton race is close, but I think in the end he will pull it out. I think, again, I think one of the problems is if we knew the partisan breakdown of the no opinion people, we'd probably find they're
mostly Republican.
They're going to vote the party line. And I think in the governor's race, what's important to note here is that the Democratic candidate put forward is former sheriff, I believe, in Dallas. And openly gay. And she actually does have some baggage regarding some things that have happened when she was sheriff over the Dallas County jails, but also her stance on immigration. And so she, while she is the party's nominee, they are not necessarily warming up to her. And so there are some hiccups there. And so this may be pulling back from some of the support she would get from the Democrats, which would make it a slightly closer race. Not one where she would win, but I think slightly closer. But one thing that's also important to note is that even if, let's say, the Democrat does not win the election, a very close election can change the way in which people govern. And so if you feel that you're not in a safe seat, you will change the way in which you govern. And so, yes, you may not win, you may not win the election, but if it is a very close race, it does change the way in which people govern. And I think a primary example of that would be the Democrat out of Alabama, who just won barely. And so he's going to be much more conservative than his other Democratic counterparts because he won in a predominantly red state.
Yeah, special election in Alabama last year to fill Jeff Sessions' seat. Sessions was a Republican senator from Alabama who became attorney general, and they had to have an election to fill his seat. And the Republican ended up getting dumped, largely because he was dating, 14-year-olds and stuff like that.
Roy Moore had a lot of controversy, and that's what helped Doug Jones out, to the point where even President Trump turned his back on Roy Moore. It was become too much baggage. That's how you see Doug Jones getting in. But Doug Jones has taken a very kind of fairly relatively hard line compared to other Democrats on immigration issues and on a number of conservative issues because he realizes he barely won that seat. And so if he wants to win re-election, he has to be highly attuned to what's going on.
Interesting. This week, while the immigration, I guess maybe last week, while the immigration crisis was unfolding and then into this week, Ted Cruz was actually out, generating, doing some candidate appearances, generating money out west, appeared on a couple of late night talk shows. Meanwhile, Beto O'Rourke went down to the border, I think very smartly, to, capture some pictures and to seem engaged on the immigration crisis. It'll be interesting to see the extent to which immigration plays out as an issue in 2018. I heard some, talking heads this weekend saying that the Republicans, they just want to get immigration off the front burner. They want to return to issues like trade. And I just think that's probably not right. I think one of the things I've noticed in the national press is that they conflate border security and immigration. And to me, I would break these two things apart. On border security, Republicans really want to talk about border security, and they may not necessarily want to talk about the wall, although many of them do, but they want to talk about border security as an issue. Then there's what to do with, the 12 million immigrants who are here, undocumented people who are here right now. And, this is largely kind of comes under the heading of pathway to citizenship or no pathway to citizenship. But what do you do to solve that undocumented worker crisis? And Democrats prefer talking about that aspect of immigration because most people support a pathway to citizenship and Republicans are kind of torn on that, right? So Democrats want to talk about that and Republicans want to talk about border security. The notion that Republicans don't want to talk about border security because of, the migrant crisis that you have right now, migrants and their children, strikes me as being incorrect. I think they want to reframe that issue, but they want to talk about it. It's one of Trump's core issues. This is purely political, by the way. We're moving from policy into politics here and talking about the elections. Now, speaking of which, there's another aspect of electoral politics that was, in the news this last week, and that was the resolution of the Texas redistricting case. And before we talk about that specific case, I'd like to run a kind of an informative video from CNN about the issue of gerrymandering, which will come up, I believe, in the third set of modules for the course. So let's take a look at that CNN info video.
Gerrymandering is why election maps across the country can look so crazy. Politicians manipulate boundaries to favor one party over another. Gerrymandering creates job security for elected officials at the expense, critics say, of fair representation. But even though politicians say they hate it, gerrymandering has been used for over 200 years. The question is, have things gone too far? The history of gerrymandering goes way back. The Constitution says that every 10 years there should be a census to determine the number of representatives each state gets. Soon after, this salamander-shaped district was drawn during the 1810 term of Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry. Gerrymander. Get it? Basically, Gerry and his successors were drawing maps to group like-minded supporters together. The idea is to make the incumbent nearly invincible and dilute your opponent's votes. Districting happens at the state level, usually in state legislatures. Some states have adopted nonpartisan map makers, and their maps make sense. Look at Colorado. But for every Colorado, there is a North Carolina, or a Maryland, or a Pennsylvania. Look at this district. What is that? The Supreme Court stepped in 1986 to toss out redistricting done on the basis of race. They affirmed that ruling in 1993 and again in early 2017. But partisan gerrymandering continues, even with some restrictions in place. The Supreme Court has recognized that politics will always be involved in drawing district maps. But critics say there are no national standards, which means the process varies wildly state by state. And they say that's unfair to voters, which is why you can expect the issue to be challenged in the court for many years to come.
Okay, a couple of small points, corrections on that video as far as I'm concerned. First of all, very small point, but Seth Maskett, who is at Denver, I think? Seth's at Denver, points out that Elbridge Gerry, his proper pronunciation is actually Gerry. And so we've been saying gerrymander for years, and it should be Gerry. He's on a one-person crusade to change the pronunciation back. So shout out to Seth for that. A more substantive point, though, is in the video, it suggests that the point of a gerrymander, I'll continue to use that nomenclature, is to make incumbents unbeatable. That's not actually right. The point of a gerrymander is to maximize the seats for one side over another side. So a racial gerrymander would minimize Hispanic or African-American seats in favor of whites. A political gerrymander is to maximize the number of Republican seats as opposed to Democrats, or vice versa, right? So I think I just want to make that small correction. All right, so what are we talking about with respect to Texas? Well, the key case here that came out this last Monday was Abbott versus Perez. And in this case, what the case decided was basically a revisiting of lines that were drawn initially in 2011. So after the census in 2011, the Texas state legislature drew maps, House districts, congressional districts, and state Senate districts for the state of Texas. And the congressional maps that were drawn up were ruled unconstitutional, violation of the voting rights of minority citizens by a court. The court then drew the lines itself. Right. This is a three-person panel in San Antonio. And they threw it back to the state legislature, and the state and said, you know, you need to do something like this. Well, the state legislature simply adopted the maps drawn by the court. Okay, so they drew the maps in 2011, they got thrown out, the court said, you know, here's what we would recommend. The state legislature just said, great, those are the new maps. So those maps instead were actually the subject, they were sued again, and the claim is kind of interesting. It said, even though the state legislature simply adopted the court-drawn maps, the lower court once again said that the maps were a violation of constitutional rights. They said that the legislature had failed to cure the discriminatory taint remaining from the legislature's initial maps. Right? Texas appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided 5-4 that, in fact, it was not the burden of the Texas legislature to remove the taint. In fact, the burden of proof is on the, plaintiff, in this case, the plaintiff to prove discriminatory intent. So, you know, it is an interesting case. Now, by the way, So there were four districts really involved. Three of the districts, they said, you know, we're not going to rule on these. They did say that the fourth district, which was a district up in Fort Worth, still didn't pass constitutional muster. So it's an interesting ruling. They did say that one, you know, whatever the court did with its maps still doesn't get at the problem there. But in the other three districts, it's not the burden of the state to have to show that by adopting the court-drawn maps, they removed the discriminatory taint. So in that sense, you could argue that it's a narrow decision, right? They didn't really rule on anything other than, again, like we were talking about last week, where they said, you know, it's the plaintiff's burden to establish something's wrong here. They basically said, you know, look, state of Texas, you know, whatever the court said about the first set of rulings in 2011, right, having discriminatory intent, by adopting the court's map at this point, you know, the state of Texas doesn't have to prove that it didn't have discriminatory intent in the first place, right? So at any rate, that means that only one district is kind of needs to be reconfigured or redone in advance of the 2018 election. And, you know, I guess at this point, since it's 2018, we'll have to wait until the 2020 census and Texas takes another whack at redistricting to have, I'm quite sure, another set of issues involving gerrymandering and apportionment. So what was your take on the maps, on the
Texas
decision here?
And this is a problem that Texas has run into for a long time. So with the 1965 Voting Rights Act, there are several states that had to gain preclearance. They had a history of discriminatory practices when it came to voting. So if any change in the voting laws or any change in the districts, they had to receive approval from the federal government. Now, the Supreme Court ruled in Shelby v. Holder that the calculation or the formula that Congress was using or that was used to say which states should have preclearance, which states should not, was outdated, and that you could no longer use preclearance unless that formula was updated. So it was put in the hands of Congress to update that formula. But because Congress has not acted, preclearance is not there, and so states now can change these laws. However, people can bring suit. And this has happened quite a bit where there have been instances where the courts have actually drawn the districts to say, no, this is the way it should look. And this issue of redistricting or the shape of the districts is extremely important because, again, as Professor Shaw pointed out, the way the districts are drawn is really to help certain groups or individuals maintain power. Now, we would think that the districts are drawn in such a way that they maintain some type of cohesion, whether it be geographic, cultural, things of that nature. But we're seeing more and more time is being taken to draw districts in a way that provide certain individuals or certain groups with a continued amount of power because of the way the districts are drawn. You're seeing this fight. We talked about this last week with Wisconsin and Maryland. You're seeing this fight going on in Pennsylvania. And so, again, there are these major concerns about, are we really getting the will of the people if we draw the districts in such a way that one group is favored over another?
Yeah, and I want to correct what I said a second ago. I indicated that of the districts under consideration that the court had ruled that one House district, let me clarify, state House district. So the congressional districts, they said, are fine. The state Senate districts, they said, were fine. There was one state House district, I think it was District 90 in Fort Worth, that Justice Alito, writing for the majority, said was an impermissible racial gerrymander, right? So there was one that got knocked out. But basically, you know, they said, I guess in the court's own words, quote, it was the challenger's burden to show that the 2013 legislature acted with discriminatory intent when it enacted plans that the court itself had produced. The 2013 legislature was not obligated to show that it had cured the unlawful intent that the court attributed to the 2011 legislature. So, you know, we were talking last week about, you know, whether people had standing and that the court wasn't going to rule on a case if they believe that the plaintiffs didn't have standing, that is, they weren't harmed. This is kind of a similar argument here. It's not a question necessarily of standing, but it's a question about what the burdens of proof are. And in this case, they basically, in some sense, sidestep the issue of gerrymandering by saying, and the court likes to do this, the court likes to defer to state legislatures on political questions. This is a sort of, not just a separation of powers issue. In fact, it's more properly, I think, understood as a federalism issue, right? The state legislature is elected, the Supreme Court is not. The Supreme Court tends to be deferential to what the state legislatures are doing within the states. Not always, but certainly on these political questions. So, We wanted to move away, so we've talked about immigration policy, talked about the elections, talked about these gerrymandering court cases. Last topic, well, next last, I got a bonus round for you. The Supreme Court also weighed in. June is just a wonderful month for us here, because the Supreme Court every couple days comes up with these, you know, decisions. They weighed in on a case that I think you guys will be very interested in. Professor McDaniel and I picked this out because we think it's not only an interesting case, but one that will be relevant, hopefully not in a criminal context for you all. But on Friday, the Supreme Court decided a case called Carpenter versus United States. And this was a very closely watched case involving how federal law enforcement agents act. And in particular, what was at issue here was that there was a question about whether the federal law enforcement agents could legally obtain 4 months' worth of cell phone location records as part of an investigation into a series of bank robberies in Michigan. I'm not exactly sure where in Michigan, but, you know, we could probably guess. The government, all right, so what are we talking about here? Well, we would draw your attention to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which is search and seizure. So the question is whether, you know, and the search and seizure provision says, you know, you shall not be subject to illegal search and seizure. So what does that mean, you know, as a practical matter? And what the courts have decided throughout the years is that, well, you know, if a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy, then the government or government agents are not allowed to search you or seize property or, you know, things from your personage, right? Now this is an interesting, you know, case though. Under what circumstances can there be a reasonable expectation of privacy? So in this particular case, a couple specifics, I just want to make sure we get the background. The government was not arguing that it could simply demand location records from a cellular provider. In fact, what it argued was that there's a particular statute, and the statute's called the Stored Communications Act. They said that that statute gives it, or gives the government, authority to get records by showing a federal magistrate, so they have to go to a federal judge, that there were, quote, reasonable grounds to believe that they were relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. So they said, you know, we can get these phone records so long as we get a judge to say there's a reasonable grounds for getting the records. In response, what the court said here, the court didn't say the government couldn't get cell phone location records, right? So you're not off the hook in that regard. What it said is that the government can do this, or federal agents can do this, provided they get a search warrant. So you might be asking, well, what's the difference between what the judge said and a search warrant? A warrant requires probable cause, not a reasonable expectation, but probable cause, right? So this is, and, you know, so that's where we are right now. The government can get cell phone records for criminal investigations to find out where somebody is, but they have to get a warrant, and that warrant is contingent upon demonstration of probable cause. All right, now, how does this fit into the Fourth Amendment stuff? Well, really, there had never been anything like this, you know, previously. You know, what had happened previously, so there's a couple of competing cases here that are involved. I just wanted to mention real quickly. There's one precedent, one kind of relevant line of reasoning in a case called Katz versus the United States. And that says, it talks about whether an individual has a reasonable expectation of privacy in a given location or doing a certain thing, right? So it's kind of the distinction to whether you're inside your home versus, you know, outside your home, right? Whereas outside your home, there's a less acute or obvious expectation of privacy. But if you're inside your home, clearly what you're doing, you're expecting that people aren't watching you, okay? So that's one, that's kind of in your person, right? Reasonable expectation of privacy in your person. Then there's this other case, and it's like several cases, and they involve what the courts refer to as third party doctrine. And that states that, and rather than whether a person has a reasonable expectation of right of privacy in their person, do you have an expectation that records associated with you are going to be private? So, and the famous case actually involves bank statements, right? Where if the government can get your bank statements, they can kind of locate where you were kind of putting money into your account, taking money out. And do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to those records? Okay, so the question then is, well, what is a cell phone? Is it something on your personage where the reasonable expectation of privacy is kind of the same as where you are as a person, right? If I'm in my home, I have an expectation, whereas if I'm in the public, or is the phone kind of closer to your bank statements, in which case it's kind of a different line of reasoning. So there's these two relevant lines of reasoning, the Katz versus United States, and then these other cases that involve kind of records, so personage and records. And, you know, here, court basically treated, and this is a little, it's an interesting case because the four liberals joined with John Roberts, the conservative Chief Justice. That's the majority, the five, that defeats the four. The four more conservative judges, Roberts notwithstanding, they dissented. And the liberals plus Roberts ruled that, you know, basically the government has to get a warrant. It can get the records, but these records, these phone records, are closer to the idea of expectation of privacy in your person than they are to records. Okay, but you know, it's kind of a fascinating idea, and these search and seizure and privacy issues you know, are getting dragged into the 21st century, right? I mean, what is your phone, and is information on your phone private? Is it sort of like you, or is it like the paper records you have, you know, in the old days, bills and banks? So
yeah, I mean, it's almost like an episode of Black Mirror of how do we reconcile our relationship with technology. But what's also important to note, and this, along with this decision, there was a decision that the court made last year dealing with search and seizure in Utah versus Sharif, where the court ruled that any evidence obtained, I guess, from an illegal search and seizure would be admitted if there is a warrant for your arrest. And so in this case, the individual was pulled over, and the car was searched, he was arrested, and he challenged, well, this was a legal search and seizure, there wasn't probable cause. And the court ruled that because he already had a warrant for his arrest, that he could, that any evidence could be admitted. And so what we're finding here is that when it comes to search and seizure, that we may be getting more liberal in some areas, we're keeping the government, putting the government at bay, and other areas we are giving a little more leeway. And so it's one of these very interesting things. We talk about civil liberties and civil rights because they're abstract. And even more so, they change with society. And so the idea of, you know, 200 years ago, nobody imagined a cell phone. And so how do we reconcile a cell phone from a home phone, things of that nature? And so again, as society changes, really the way we understand our rights and our liberties changes as well. And so this will be very interesting to see that how much civil liberties and civil rights are in many ways social constructions and are constantly being updated as we progress as a society.
It's, you know, the case itself, if you read the decision, I don't know that I'd recommend reading some of these decisions. If you're interested in this stuff, SCOTUS blog, Supreme Court of the United States, SCOTUS blog, is pretty cool. It does a really good breakdown on these things. And there was actually kind of a lot of speculation in this case about, you know, yes, it's 21st century technology, but could you put yourself in the minds of the framers, right? You're talking about, you know, phones essentially are for, you know, conversations. They're for a lot of other things too, but we're really talking about are conversations. And would the framers think that these conversations had an expectation of privacy? And was the government allowed to do this? I would point out also that as Professor McDaniel is hinting at, the coalitions here on the court are kind of odd. I mean, you'd think maybe that the liberals would you know, see their way towards a more expansive conception of the federal government, and therefore they would be in favor of this. But that's not where the liberals were on this. The liberals were very much for the sort of civil libertarian side. The conservatives, I think, picking up on the law enforcement aspect of it, said, you know, well, the government, you know, has a, you know, can do this. They went to a federal magistrate, you know, and so for the conservatives, they thought this was okay because of the process that was involved, and probably because they thought that, you know, for the most part, we're talking about people who are accused, well, hopefully for the entire part, people who are accused of a crime. So, you know, I wouldn't have been able to guess what the coalition was here, and it ends up being, you know, four liberals plus a pretty conservative Chief Justice and John Roberts. So, but anyway, this is an interesting question, and we're hoping you guys kind of pick up on these things. What we want to do with the class is, you know, take these constitutional concepts and federalism and things like that and kind of bring them up today because, you know, as you see with the Supreme Court over the last couple of weeks, these things are constant. We're still navigating this stuff. We're still trying to figure out what do these guarantees and civil rights and civil liberties mean in the context of 21st century America? So with that, we wanted to end with one last thing before we sign off and send you guys off for the week and to take the second exam, and that is sharks. We're very, well, I'm pro-shark. I'm not sure what Professor McDaniel's position is on sharks. And I got to say, I found the most recent tweet from our president a little disappointing on this. Can we put that tweet up? Okay. Sorry, folks. I'm just not a fan of sharks. And don't worry, though, they'll be around long after we are gone. I don't know what I think about the president's tweeting generally. I find this one of the funniest things I've read in the past 6 months. Sorry. So he's apologizing. You got to break this down. He's apologizing, I guess, to people like me, the pro-shark community. He's just not a fan. But then he reassures us, don't worry, they'll be around long after we're gone. So there's the apology, there's the explanation, but then there's the, you know, it's okay because we're going to be dead and they're going to be around for a long time.
Yeah, and then this is 5 years ago, so he may have updated his beliefs about sharks since then.
I see this as being, you know, I said recent quote, but I don't know, maybe he's flip-flopped on sharks. You know, if he's looking for re-election, I don't know. But I say this to y'all because summer is here. We've actually had a couple of shark incidents in Alabama. I don't know what's going on in Alabama, but more importantly, Shark Week is coming up soon. So I would,
I think Sharknado 29 is coming out. So
I left off with Sharknado 4. Have we gone beyond that?
I think a Sharknado 6 is coming out. Okay. Truthful.
All right. So if you can tie Sharknado or Shark Week into any kind of government assessment or interpretation, we're very much impressed.
Well, I think Sharknado 4, they actually go after the Capitol.
I think you're right. Think that's right. All right. So with that, we're out for the week. I'm Professor Shaw.
I'm Professor McDaniel.
We'll see you next time.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.